This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
We're proud to be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Delanderos-Tierre has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the new Bush budget would sell off billions of dollars worth of national forest lands, including 730 acres in the Columbia Gorge.
The lawyer shot by Vice President Cheney is out of the hospital.
Violent protests against cartoon depictions of the Prophet Muhammad entered into their fifth day today.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,273 officially acknowledged deaths of North American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports 32,041 civilians have been reported killed by military aggression in Iraq. Last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 17th, 2006. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Annalisa Hummel. George W. Bush's $2.77 trillion budget would hike military spending almost 7% and make permanent his first-term tax cuts. The budget also ties support for schools and services in rural counties to a program that would sell off $1 billion worth of national forest lands, including 730 acres in the Columbia Gorge. KBOO's Stephanie Potter has more.
A federal payment program that helps to support schools and services in rural counties was expected to be axed by the Bush administration. Instead, in his budget proposal for 2007, Bush would gradually reduce the program by as much as 60% over 5 years and revert to tying it to timber sales after that. In the meantime, the program would be paid for with the sales of national forest lands. 10,000 acres have been targeted in Oregon, including 22 parcels in the Columbia Gorge.
The Forest Service has identified 730 acres within the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area to put up on the auction blocks to sell off to the highest bidder.
Michael Lang with the Friends of the Columbia Gorge.
While some people in the administration are saying that, oh, these are far-flung, difficult-to-manage parcels, there are none within scenic areas, and the administration has also said, you know, these are little parcels that are in people's neighborhood that probably nobody knows are Forest Service or BLM land. The fact is, from what we've seen, that is not true.
Lang emphasized that important values would be compromised by these sales.
Many of the parcels that we've identified so far are on critical landscapes that are visible from very important public key viewing areas or very close to public trails like the Pacific Crest National Scenic Trail, or have a high probability of containing cultural resources.
According to Lang, conservationists across the country are opposed to this proposal.
But more interestingly, county governments are opposed. I believe it was a Douglas County commissioner spoke out saying that the sale of these lands will only produce a short-term revenue flow that will in no way make up for the lost federal revenue that has provided rural counties with necessary funds for education, for roads, and for other essential county services.
Julie Cox, representing the National Forest Service, stressed that nothing has yet been finalized.
You know, we all very well know and understand we have pretty major budget concerns nationally, so this is not an announcement of sale of lands. It's a proposal to look at a way to fund some legislation.
Stephen Homer of the United Forest Defense Campaign would like the Bush administration to look for other sources of funding.
Even if you look at the Forest Service's budget, the timber sale program loses huge amounts of money each year for the taxpayers. The last reliable estimate that was done by the Government Accountability Office suggests that the agency loses over $300 million a year. Now, over 5 years, that's $1.5 billion. And so if you want to look, you know, for a place to find the money, you know, I think the timber sale program would be a good place to start.
But according to Homer, the administration is ready to spend even more money on timber sales.
Just about every single Forest Service program is going to face a significant cut this year under the 2007 budget, except for the timber sale program, which will see a 10% increase.
Steve Peretti of the Oregon Natural Resources Council is concerned that another motivation of the Bush administration is to pit conservationists against rural counties.
Bush administration had actually opposed renewal of the county payments program up until this budget was announced. So it's kind of interesting that they sort of did a flip-flop, but only to the extent that it was useful for them in creating this sort of politically charged conflict.
Meanwhile, Michael Lang is hopeful that the sales will face major opposition.
Friends of the Columbia Gorge and many other environmental groups will help the public find out who to comment to and how to direct their comments. We expect this to be very unpopular among people in Oregon and Washington and across the country, and we also expect this not to receive very much support in Congress. However, it's very early, and we cannot take anything for granted.
Michael Lang, Friends of the Columbia Gorge, who is hoping that citizen involvement can keep the Bush administration from selling off public lands. I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
An educational forum on grand juries, snitches, criminal prosecution, and the use of federal informants rolls into Portland tomorrow night. It's called the Grand Jury Roadshow. Live with us in Studio 2 is civil liberties attorney Lauren Regan. She'll be the headliner of the event. Lauren, thanks for coming to Portland.
Thank you for having me.
Why did you decide to create this event, and where are you traveling with it?
Well, we decided to have the roadshow right now because of the current onslaught of grand juries that are hitting the Northwest with regard to the eco cases that are being prosecuted in Eugene. But in addition to that, we were really feeling the need to address some of the Bush administration issues, like the Patriot Act reauthorization, the warrantless wiretapping, and some of the other just kind of flagrant policy problems that are going on with the government right now. So we're going to tie it all together and give people some background and some legal education so that they can better understand the news and better understand what's going on in our own communities.
So we hear that term grand jury all the time. What exactly is a grand jury?
Well, a grand jury is a secret proceeding where criminal investigators are allowed to compel citizens to testify potentially against themselves or others. They're held in secret. There are 23 citizens that are on grand juries usually. And when somebody receives a grand jury subpoena, they have no choice but to come and to testify against friends, loved ones, whoever, unless they decide that they're going to not testify and can be found in contempt of court, which can end you up in jail for up to 18 months.
The KBOO News carried a report yesterday about the subpoena, the grand jury subpoena that local activist Craig Rosebrough received this week. So what are a person's rights under that kind of arrangement, and how much time can he get if he doesn't talk?
Well, in grand jury proceedings, when someone chooses not to speak to the grand jury, it is called a contempt proceeding. And basically, there is an adage that says someone who is found in contempt of a grand jury proceeding holds the key to their own jail cell. And what they mean by that is you can purge the contempt or you can get out of jail simply by agreeing to testify. But if you choose not to testify for ethical or other reasons, you can be imprisoned for the duration of that grand jury, which normally they last 18 months, but they can be extended under certain circumstances for up to 3 years. So normally people are looking at prison sentences of easily a year, although there are certain legal motions that can be brought that if they can prove that they are never going to testify, that because of ethical issues or other reasons, they are simply not ever going to agree to testify to the grand jury, there is a proceeding to get out of jail based on those reasons.
So do you think this grand jury system is fair, and is it really effective as a law enforcement tool?
Well, I think that there are some problems with it, and the problems are mounting. Historically, grand juries were secret because they were to protect the reputations of those that were accused of crimes. The government has kind of taken that secrecy and turned it against the people that are being accused of crimes and their communities, the witnesses that are being called in. And we'll discuss that a lot more during the presentation.
All right. Thank you. That was Lauren Regan of the Grand Jury Roadshow. The event is tomorrow at 7 p.m. at Laughing Horse Books, 3652 Southeast Division. Also next Wednesday, the 22nd, at 7 p.m. at Liberty Hall, which is at 311 North Ivy Street in Portland. You can find out more on the web at the Civil Liberties Defense Center, www.cldc.org.
George W. Bush's science advisor told U.S. Representative David Wu this week that he would look into the government's suspension of funding for an Oregon State University forest study. The study results undermine the Bush administration's stance on logging after wildfires. This Tuesday, John Marburger, science advisor to Bush and director of the Office of Science and Technology Policy, said he would report back to Congress on the OSU case and other allegations. Wu contends that the administration had interfered in the science for political reasons. Wu, a Democrat from Portland, called the OSU episode, quote, truly, truly troubling, during a Wednesday meeting on the House Committee on Science, where Marburger testified. The U.S. Bureau of Land Management suspended funding for the study after scientists from OSU's College of Forestry and the U.S. Forest Service reported that logging sets back recovery of burned forests. The scientists had studied lands burned by the 2002 Biscuit Fire and published their results in the journal Science.
Stay tuned for Counterspin following our newscast at 5:55 here, Independent Native News. Then at 6, Bread and Roses. At 7, Essence of Soul with Shahid Hamid. Tonight's weather mostly clear, cold, and windy. Lows 15 to 25 degrees. Corvallis can expect mostly clear skies with a low around 18, and Hood River and the Gorge will be mostly clear with a low of around 12 degrees. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with highs around 40. Corvallis can expect mostly sunny with a high of 41, and Hood River and the Gorge mostly sunny with a high of 37. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
The lawyer shot by Vice President Cheney is out of the hospital. Harry Whittington appeared outside the hospital to tell reporters that he was very sorry for the trouble that the vice president had been through in the past week. It was Whittington's first public appearance after he was shot in the face, neck, and chest during a hunting trip at a South Texas ranch. Whittington had been recovering in the Corpus Christi hospital. He suffered a mild heart attack after a shotgun pellet traveled to his heart. A hospital spokeswoman wouldn't say exactly when Whittington left the hospital or where he was going, only that he left in a car. Cheney told the Wyoming legislature today that Whittington was, quote, on the mend and doing well.
The call for closure of the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center by the UN has been rejected by the White House. The U.S. maintains that the detainees held there are dangerous terrorists. A report published yesterday said that treatment of some of the Guantanamo Bay detainees constituted torture and recommended the U.S. close the camp. The findings were based on interviews with former prisoners, detainees, lawyers, and families by five U.N. experts. Around 500 people are being held at the U.S. military camp in Cuba.
The Food and Drug Administration says women ought to discuss with their doctors the risk of wearing a birth control patch. The makers of the Ortho Evra patch say one study suggests the risks of blood clots in legs and lungs may be twice as high for women using the patch as it is for women who pay. An investigation by the Associated Press last year found higher rates of blood clots in women who use the patches. Dr. Daniel Shames with the FDA says the preliminary findings need analysis and don't require immediate government action. And Shames, or Shames, says clots remain, quote, fairly unusual events. 4 months ago, the FDA warned women that increased hormones released by the patch could cause blood clots and other serious side effects.
It's 5:15. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Shh! ExxonMobil doesn't want any attention paid to its latest profit report. How big was their profit last year? Shh! Let's whisper it together. $36 billion. For 1 year. Holy robber baron. That's an embarrassment of riches. A jaw-dropping 40% leap over the previous year. No wonder they don't want us rabble to notice, since that $36 billion was picked right out of our pockets by Exxon's gas pumps. This ripoff is so politically explosive that ExxonMobil even tried a preemptive PR campaign before releasing the profit number in hopes of dampening criticism. It organized slideshows for journalists and took out full-page ads to proclaim that, golly, its profit margins actually are lower than those of drug companies and banks. Come on, the drug kings and big bankers are notorious thieves. Is this comparison supposed to make us feel better? The bottom line is that ExxonMobil just hauled off the biggest profit in the history of corporate America at a time that prices at their pumps continue to rise and when working families are already stretched to the breaking point. Luckily, George W. is on the job. Lucky for ExxonMobil, that is. In his energy bill passed last November, he included another $2 billion in tax breaks for oil giants that are wallowing in windfall profits. He also killed a provision that would have required a reduction in U.S. oil consumption by 1 million barrels a day by 2015. And when a Senate tax bill added a one-year tax increase of $5 billion on the largest oil corporations, Bush rushed to the defense of the ExxonMobils, promising to veto the bill. This is Jim Hightower saying, 15 of America's largest environmental groups have organized a campaign to rein in Exxon's excess. To join the effort, go to exposeexxon.com. That's EXXPOSEExxon.com. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at motherjones.com.
Denmark has closed its embassy in Pakistan as violent protests against cartoon depictions of the Islamic prophet Muhammad entered into their fifth day today. FSRN's Masroor Hussein reports from Islamabad.
Pakistani police arrested around 150 Islamists all over the country in what was claimed to be a preemptive crackdown on potential troublemakers to stop Friday's demonstrations from turning into a repeat of this week's bloody anti-Western riots, in which five people have died. In Peshawar, a religious leader offered a $1 million reward for the death of the cartoonists. Weeks of low-key protests in Pakistan turned into violent displays of anger at the West and discontent with the government of President General Pervez Musharraf. Protests are also expected on March 3, the day U.S. President Bush visits Pakistan. For Free Speech Radio News, Masroor Hussein, Islamabad.
With New Orleans Mardi Gras substantially reduced this winter, travelers here in the Northwest will flock to Rio next week for Brazil's flagship Carnival, a globally renowned festival of national dance, costume, design, and music. KBOO cultural reporter Michael Jean Horowitz delved into the origins of what's become this festival's signature music, samba.
Sampling from my notes for this report is Anise Teles Ferreira, a Brazilian instructor of English language at the Spanish and English International School at Portland Public Schools Roosevelt Campus.
Urban origin.
It developed here in Rio from the end of slavery in the late 1880s through the first decades of the 20th century. It began by the harbor in the Saúde district, where the majority of freed slaves were living. They were fleeing the oppression of the coffee plantations in the interior. I say oppression because with the end of slavery, the paternalism of slavery was replaced by an even harsher agrarian regimen. So here in Rio, samba became the common tongue of those occupying the lower ranks of the economic structure. Public servants, migrant workers, freed slaves, and people of mixed blood. Coincidentally, there was change afoot in the political status quo of Rio. A certain kind of progressive politics was developing. From 1904 through 1908, huge municipal reforms were enacted. A new kind of political consciousness seemed to be emerging, the notion of national citizenship. Brazil was evolving from a monarchic, land-based society into an industrial, republican one. Samba gatherings initially evoked hostility and suspicion. Downtown leaders complained about the distracting noise. Newspapers decried falling standards of civilization fomented by dangerous classes. Later, there was objection to the introduction of samba into carnival. The press complained that carnival was becoming tainted with barbarous dances. Itself amalgamated several different cultures. It absorbed many European instruments, as well as aspects of European musical theater, opera, marches, waltzes, mazurkas, and Portuguese fado. In addition, samba was strongly influenced by the religious beliefs of Southern Africa, from which Brazil had derived its slaves. It also borrowed the rhythmic pattern of the region, two or four beats against one. One can speak of two phases in its development. Before 1920, early recordings typically capture only a single guitar, ukulele, or flute, accompanying a group of singers. But by the end of the 1920s, abetted by the explosion of the recording industry, the mix had produced an entirely new musical form.
Não vem, que assim não dá. Mas quem é você? Pra me criticar, não vem, não, não vem, não sai pra lá.
Não vem, e assim não dá.
And after 1930, that basic form hardly changes. Sambistas have certainly been known to deviate from it, but only occasionally.
Samba can be heard next week not only at Carnival's two grand parades, but in the numerous bandas, informal processions that dance their way through Rio's neighborhoods. The festival launches with the crowning of King Momo on Friday the 24th. Look for you at the Sambódromo, Anise.
Até mais tarde no Carnaval, Miguel.
For Cable Culture, this is Miguel Horowitz saying, tchau, amigos.
A landslide triggered by 10 days of heavy rains has buried an entire village in central Philippines. The exact number of casualties is not yet known, but four persons have been confirmed dead and many hundreds are missing. Red Cross officials estimate that as many as 200 might be dead and another 1,500 are missing. The landslide hit the village of Ginsagun on the southern part of the Leyte Island.
A team of four Tamil Tiger rebels are on their way to Geneva for crucial peace talks with the Sri Lankan government. The meeting will be the first high-level face-to-face talks for nearly 3 years. A ceasefire facilitated by Norway was agreed in 2002, with peace talks stalling in 2003. The Tamil Tigers want autonomy for minority Tamils in the north and east. More than 60,000 people have died during the two decades of conflict.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 17, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203, or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM, on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM, on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Kirk Vanderveer. Our assistant producer is Joshua Johnson, and tonight's audio editors are Noah Eaton and Rochelle Saliba. Special thanks to reporter Stephanie Potter and Michael Jean Horowitz. Our engineer is D.R. Garrett. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, here the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, Chris Andre guest hosts Talk Radio. Her guest is Peter Schoonmaker of the Illahi Lecture Series. They'll discuss upcoming programs in their series on peak oil. At 9, it's the Old Mole Variety Hour. At 10, on the Food Show, everything you need to know about olive oil, including an interview with Oregon's first olive grower. And at 11, Democracy Now! The KBOO Evening News is preempted. Monday will feature a live call-in show hosted by Eduardo Denderos Tierre and Ivan Rivero and Carlos Chavez. That's Monday night at 5. That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-owned community radio station. Thanks for joining us. There was a graffiti seen at Southwest 10th and Main in Portland. The vultures are well-fed.
Good night, Liam.
Good night, Annalisa.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, an Australian television program aired new images of abuse at Abu Ghraib prison, images the Pentagon had fought in court to keep covered up. The various administration lines on why no one should see the pictures are depressing, if not surprising. But what about the fact that a number of U.S. media outlets have evidently been sitting on the images for some time? We'll hear from Emily Whitfield of the ACLU, which has been fighting the Pentagon for the release of these images, along with much other information about U.S. treatment of prisoners. Also this week, would you like to pay less for TV? Recent moves in Washington seem to be paving the way for a so-called a la carte approach to cable, where consumers only pay for the channels they want. Who's behind this effort, and will it really be a win for the public, or just another way for media giants to control the flow of information? We'll ask Kenneth DeGraff of Consumers Union. All of that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
When George Bush announced on February 9th that an Al-Qaeda plot targeting the Library Tower building in Los Angeles had been thwarted, many television newscasts reported his claim as fact. That evening, ABC World News Tonight anchor Charles Gibson reported, quote, President Bush today revealed some details of a terrorist plot that was foiled, close quote. Later, ABC reporter Pierre Thomas ended a segment by concluding that disaster was averted. The same night, CBS Evening News anchor Bob Schieffer announced that, quote, for the first time, President Bush confirmed today that in the months after 9/11, the government broke up another terrorist plot, close quote. Of course, the fact that Bush says something does not confirm that what he is saying is true. The next day, CNN's Miles O'Brien was also unquestioning, quote, the president was talking terror yesterday and lifting a veil on a thwarted Al-Qaeda attack, close quote. And Fox's Bill O'Reilly, naturally, was upset that the media weren't credulous enough, singling out the New York Times for failing to give the story prominent placement. But that Times report went easy on Bush, while some newspapers noted marked dissent over his claim. On February 10th, the Washington Post cited several U.S. intelligence officials who said there was, quote, deep disagreement within the intelligence community over the seriousness of the Library Tower scheme and whether it was ever much more than talk, close quote. The New York Daily News quoted a senior counterterrorism official saying, quote, there was no definitive plot. It never materialized or got past the thought stage, close quote. Such skepticism should be the norm, particularly with this White House's record. Unfortunately, some high-profile journalists seem intent on being taken in time and time again.
When former FEMA Chief Michael Brown finally appeared before the Republican committee investigating the government's failures around Hurricane Katrina, he didn't hold his tongue like most Bush appointees have done when under fire, and his testimony pointed the finger all the way up the chain of command. With testimony from Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff on the way, as well as the committee's report, which was correctly expected to be pretty scathing, you'd think journalists would be looking to do some hard-hitting reporting, to dig for the truth on the Katrina story. But for CBS's top journalist, Bob Schieffer, the story was over before it started. On the February 12th edition of Face the Nation, before the committee's report even came out, Schieffer made his interest in the investigation clear. Quote, I now declare I know all I need to know about the government bumbling after Hurricane Katrina, close quote. Schieffer announced that hypocrisy over Katrina was at flood level, criticizing both Brown for pointing the finger all the way up to Bush and the Democrats for portraying him as some kind of victim. Give me a break, Schieffer pleaded, and proclaimed that all we need to know about Katrina is that, quote, this was a failure of government at every level and that the Department of Homeland Security is a monumental flop, close quote. Of course, there's much we still don't know about Katrina, particularly since the Bush administration is stonewalling requests for information. And, a little aspect of the story Schieffer didn't mention, virtually no one has been held accountable. But apparently the public can't expect CBS's evening news anchor to care about that.
Pundits were buzzing last week about a testy exchange between Senators John McCain and Barack Obama. At issue was lobbying reform. McCain was pitching one reform plan, and Obama decided to support another one. Big deal, right? Well, apparently it was to McCain, who wrote Obama a scathing letter, accusing him of exploiting the issue, being disingenuous, and noting sarcastically that, quote, in politics, the public interest isn't always a priority for every one of us, close quote. Ouch. Obama responded by writing that he was puzzled by McCain's letter, pledged not to get into any partisan name-calling, and professed his deep respect for McCain, the guy who just insulted him. But to some reporters, the exchange was yet another example of bad behavior all around, a not-so-helpful media trend we like to call false balance. The New York Times wrote on February 9th that the pair, quote, traded and made public stinging letters about lobbying overhaul, close quote. When asked by Counterspin what Obama may have written that might be considered stinging, reporter Cheryl Gay Stolberg told us it was perhaps a subtle sting, whatever that is. Likewise, U.S. News columnist Mort Zuckerman wrote in the magazine's February 20th issue about, quote, the stinging exchange of letters between John McCain and Barack Obama, close quote, which he saw as part of a lamentable trend away from a real revival of centrism that is apparently bound to save our political discourse. It's a baffling situation. One senator lashes out at a colleague, and the media story is about how both sides are getting too nasty. But perhaps such bending over backward to be even-handed is especially crucial when the senator in question is media darling John McCain.
The Valerie Plame CIA leak investigation continues. The latest news is quite intriguing. Dick Cheney's former chief of staff, Scooter Libby, according to a February 9th report in the National Journal, told a grand jury that he was authorized by his superiors to leak classified information to reporters back in 2003 in order to rebut critics of the war, most notably Plame's husband, Joe Wilson. That revelation sparked a media discussion about how all administrations leak such information. It's a no-no, technically speaking, but a common enough practice inside the Beltway. As David Gergen told CNN's Wolf Blitzer on February 9th, quote, when it's convenient, a lot of administrations have used classified out there and leaked it out there to favor their case, close quote. But this line of discussion missed the fundamental point. Libby was not merely leaking classified information, he was trying to plant misinformation. The story Libby tried to pass along to New York Times reporter Judith Miller alleged that Iraq's nuclear weapons plans were far worse than anyone had been saying publicly, but that all the details were in the classified national intelligence estimate. But, as Newsweek.com pointed out last October, the classified document did not say that. In fact, it said nearly the opposite. So the story here is not that Libby was just dropping sensitive information to reporters, he was lying to them. At this stage of the Iraq War, the pundit's failure to say so clearly speaks volumes.
And finally, we are simply looking for provocative ideas. That's how CNN President Jonathan Klein explained the network's decision to hire conservative pontificator Bill Bennett. Presumably Klein means provocative, like Bennett's remarks last year that, quote, you could abort every black baby in this country and your crime rate would go down, close quote. According to a February 13th New York Times article, Klein's thoughts about that controversy are that Bennett, quote, explained himself very clearly and well, close quote, and further that he is, quote, a guy who has some very evolved thoughts and is not afraid to express them, close quote. Klein noted that CNN considers itself to be in competition with a bigger universe of programming than just news, saying, we also compete with Dancing with the Stars and Skating with Celebrities. Hiring folks like Bill Bennett is, of course, part of CNN's transparent effort to capture Fox News Channel's right-wing audience. Then again, if Bennett's knee-jerk association of black people and crime is Klein's idea of evolved thinking, perhaps this is just the news network to compete with celebrity ice skating.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The Australian television program Dateline recently aired previously unseen images of the abuse of Iraqi prisoners at Abu Ghraib. They include images of some prisoners with violent and open wounds, one slamming his head repeatedly against a door, and some dead bodies, with the circumstances of the deaths unclear. The show's producer called the images a quantum leap in terms of the seriousness of the apparent abuse, and noted, it does add a lot to what we know was going on there. That's not the line the U.S. media are taking, though. In a February 16th story, The Washington Post, which acknowledged that they have in fact had these images and more since 2004, stated flatly in its lead sentence that the images, quote, did not depict previously unknown abuse and were similar to photographs published earlier by news outlets in the United States, close quote. Though Post executive editor Len Downey offered another, much stranger rationale in an online chat in 2004, calling some of the images, quote, so shocking and in such bad taste, especially the extensive nudity, that they are not publishable in our newspaper, close quote, as if taste had any relevance in a discussion about torture. But if there's no real news here, as that tone suggests, then why did the Pentagon fight so hard to keep these images hidden from the public? We're joined now by telephone by Emily Whitfield, Media Relations Director of the National ACLU. Welcome back to Counterspin, Emily Whitfield.
Thanks, Janine.
Well, the implication of that lead from the Washington Post is that this is nothing new, but it seems that there is something different about the content of these images. Your experience in trying to get the Pentagon to release them would seem to be testimony to that. Tell us some of the background. What has been the administration's stance on these pictures up to now?
Well, in a word, I would have to say stonewalling. The administration clearly did not want these photos to come out. They have been fighting this in the courts, despite a very strong decision we got from a judge in New York saying that these images ought to come out and that we cannot make claims that something terrible is going to happen as a result of the images being released. What I think is really missing here in the big story is not, oh, we've seen some of these pictures before, this, that, or the other picture before. What's missing from the big story is the fact that the government has done nothing to address this scandal. And we're going to see this happen over and over again. Just this morning, Salon.com claimed to have over 1,000 photos and put things on their website. So these things are going to come out because it's in the nature of the modern world that there are video cameras, that there's digital equipment, and that there's soldiers and other people out there recording these abuses and these torture incidents. And whatever the Pentagon might like to say about how we can't have them, the truth is going to come out.
Well, the lead for the Associated Press February 16th reflected another major theme of media's presentation, which echoes this Pentagon line. They said the images came out, quote, amid U.S. concerns, the photographs could heighten anti-U.S. sentiments in the Middle East and endanger the lives of American troops, close quote. You've started to address this. The Pentagon evidently made this argument in court, and the judge said that's not good enough, right?
The judge did say that's not good enough, and the point anyway is that the photos are now out there. The photos are out there, the earlier photos are out there, and maybe these other images are out there too that are inflaming people. But the reason that people are and continue to be inflamed and upset by this is because they see no action, no responsibility taken on the part of the U.S. government. A few low-level people are convicted. That's not right. That's not what should be happening. The ACLU has actually sued Rumsfeld, Janice Karpinski, and other military top leaders because we believe those are the people who should be held accountable. And until that happens, this kind of violence and these kinds of things may come and go, but until the rest of the world sees that the U.S. has taken responsibility, there's going to be continued scandal and continued problems with our image.
And, of course, there's this confusion about the images inflaming anger as if it weren't, in fact, the actions depicted
exactly
in the images that inflame mm-hmm. the anger. In fact, the AP kind of semantically twisted the Iraqi response on that. They talked about concerns that the images could upset people, and then the AP had it, quote, in Baghdad, Iraq's prime minister condemned the latest abuse images, close quote. And then the quote they had was the Iraqi prime minister saying, the Iraqi government condemns the torture practices revealed through the recent pictures that show Iraqi prisoners being tortured. I thought that was a real kind of semantic sleight of hand on AP's part to make it seem that everyone's just cared about the pictures themselves.
Yeah, that is a nice little trick. And I really do think that the media is missing the bigger, literally the bigger picture here, or maybe I should say figuratively the bigger picture, which is that as long as those images are out there with no accountability being taken, they can talk about how, oh, it's the same old photo, we're not interested in writing about it. At the same time, they're interested in talking about how the images are inflaming people. So which is it going to be?
Exactly. Well, the Australian producer said that he thought other outlets must have these images. You've just talked about Salon.com. And he said it was strange that they haven't released them. But the fact that U.S. media are downplaying this story is not a surprise to you, I suppose. You have experience of journalists seeming to go out of their way to dismiss this story, or at least aspects of it. Isn't that true?
I think that is true, that especially when this new round of photos have come out, there seems to be a reluctance to acknowledge what this means in terms of the administration's culpability. And further, I happen to know that many, many journalists who knew that the ACLU itself is pursuing and continues to pursue these images were extremely eager to get their hands on them. But maybe that was really more about getting the get than it was about the big story.
And your experience with CNN in trying to talk about the issues of prisoner abuse have indicated that, you know, you're not always working in the most hospitable territory in terms of just getting the data out. There's almost kind of a poo-pooing of it.
I certainly expect skepticism on the part of journalists and for them to investigate a story for themselves. But we brought over from Iraq two men who were part of our lawsuit against Donald Rumsfeld, two men who had been the subject of torture and abuse by U.S. soldiers. And they came over to tell their story. And I think for the most part, they were treated, their stories were treated with respect by the journalists. But this journalist that we work with at CNN, Tom Foreman, not only did not treat our clients with respect, but with outright disbelief and dismissiveness. In the story that CNN did, there were just many, many elisions of facts and a major amount of editorial spin on his story. He repeatedly said that he was dismissive and doubtful of our client's story. And he reported something that the Pentagon said in response to it that made it sound as though Donald Rumsfeld was accusing our clients of being insurgents, when in fact they had been found innocent by the U.S. authorities, which is why they had been released.
Well, I'm going to bring you back to a point that you've been underscoring all this time, which is the implication of comments from a Defense Department spokesman that are turning up in the press, is that in fact the people responsible for the abuse that's depicted in these images have been investigated. And that accountability, of course, is the key to the story. I want to ask you finally, where are we in reality on that? And how do we think of these new images in that context? Because obviously people's reaction is going to be, what has been done about this when they see these photos?
Well, first of all, in fact, there are new images in those photos and new angles and new aspects and also new information. Not all of these photos have been seen before.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that there's new information for us to understand what was going on over there. And there could be new charges brought as a result. But the charges should be brought against the higher-ups. The Pentagon loves to say that these things have been investigated, but over and over again, through the over 90,000 documents that the ACLU obtained through our Freedom of Information Act request, we have seen that these so-called investigations were extremely cursory, dismissed a lot of information that could have given them a lot more, pointing to the higher-ups, and these investigations were not complete, and we certainly do not concede that they are at all. But it makes a nice soundbite to say so.
Well, let me ask you, Emily, now that the images are out there, as you say, does that have implication for the ACLU's court case? What's the next step for the ACLU?
Our court case is certainly continuing, and in fact, I think the implications are probably for the best, because we'll be able to now point to the fact that these images are out there. How can the government credibly continue to deny us these images when the rest of the world seems to be looking at them? And how can they credibly say that that all these dire things are going to happen as a result of these images being out? And we certainly hope that no violence and no bad incidents are related to the release of these images. So our court case is going to continue. There may well be more images and documents that we haven't yet seen. So this is a story that's ongoing. And as I said, it's going to continue until we see the government take some responsibility, either on its own or through force of our lawsuit and lawsuits that others are bringing.
We've been speaking with Emily Whitfield, Media Relations Director of the National ACLU. You can follow their work on these issues on their website, which is aclu.org. Thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin, Emily Whitfield.
You're very welcome.
If you're like most people, your bill for cable TV keeps going up, and there's a good chance that you get a whole lot more channels than you actually watch. So what if you were able to pay only for what you wanted to see on your TV set? If the current discussion in Washington is any indication, that might soon be a reality. So what is this a la carte cable idea all about? And will it give us more control over our TV sets or less? Joining us now to explain it is Kenneth DeGraff. He's a policy advocate for Consumers Union in Washington, D.C. Kenneth DeGraff, thanks for joining us here on Counterspin.
Hi, good afternoon.
Now, the idea seems sensible enough. You allow citizens more choice over what channels they get and consequently how much they pay for those channels. The argument we're hearing from the other side goes something like this. Well, you can't get a subscription to one section of the daily newspaper, so why should you get to pick and choose your TV channels? That's what they're saying. Does that make any sense?
It really doesn't work that way in the real world. The New York Times offers a sports section that is from the New York Times. They write it themselves. It'd be more like a different program on the same channel. What's really the situation is that you're calling to get Fortune magazine, but in order to get Fortune, you've also got to take Sports Illustrated, Better Home and Gardens, and, you know, something else like Field and Stream, all Time Warner publications, by the way, mm-hmm. in order to get the one thing you actually really wanted.
So what will a la carte mean in practice?
Well, we're advocating for an approach that would give consumers more choices, whether they want to pick and choose their channels individually, whether they want to purchase channels on a themed tier like a sports tier, or even having the choice to pick and choose their channels on a flexible pick 15 for $15 kind of tier and arrangement, or if they'd rather do the simple thing and get the same options that they currently have. But unfortunately, they only have the option to currently get almost all channels or almost no channels.
And a lot of those channels are brought to you by the good folks that own the cable system, so it's no surprise that you have to get those channels. One of the proposals on the table right now are for what they are calling family-friendly tiers of programming. Presumably this is some sort of special package for more conservative viewers who might want to tune out material they find objectionable. What does Consumers Union make of that proposal?
Well, after all these years of saying, for the cable company saying that you can't do a la carte, it's just impossible, technically infeasible, all of a sudden, now the conservatives have political pressure on them, mm-hmm. they can create a family tier. Well, that family tier doesn't include any sports programming. A lot of families might want to watch that too. So if they can create a family tier, they could create a sports tier or a tier where you can pick your own channels. They're just trying to control what you watch and not give that control to you.
Now, is that family tier the result of right-wing lobbying in Washington? Did they just get what they asked for?
Actually, many conservative groups don't want the family tier because it's still somebody else deciding for that family what's family appropriate. They actually believe, including the Parents Television Council and other groups like Concerned Women for America, Focus on the Family, and the American Family Association, want to give the same consumers the same choices that you and I want to have. Mm-hmm. They don't want to ban programming. They don't want to ban certain channels and have the government censor stuff. They just want to give that control to families to make that decision for themselves.
Now, as I understand this, the FCC studied this whole a la carte idea a while back, and they concluded that it wasn't feasible and it wouldn't save anyone any money. Recently, they've done another study, and they've kind of reversed course. What do you make of that? What happened?
Well, the current FCC study actually looks at both sides of the economic arguments and discovers that the cable industry-funded studies that the first report relied on had gross mathematical errors and made hideous assumptions on what consumers would watch and how they would watch television. The earlier report actually said that consumers would watch 2 hours less TV per day than they do with no choices, with this big bundle of channels. It's a ridiculous assumption, and when you correct for that assumption, you find that they found in the new report that consumers could save up to 13% off their cable bills by having more choices.
Now let's talk about opposition. You mentioned some of the right-wing groups or conservative groups that have been advocating for their version of this. Presumably somebody isn't crazy about this idea. Who isn't yet on board, so to speak?
Well, a lot of free marketeers on the conservative side aren't on board, but what they're not understanding, though, is that there's no free market for cable TV. You can't choose and pick that you want one sports channel over another because this one costs less, like you can in a real free market. So they're trying to support a monopoly from the cable companies.
Now, there is also this argument I've heard from some public interest advocates that this could potentially open up new channels that at this moment wouldn't be able to get on the air. They could say, set aside this channel, and if you want to pick it up and it's going to be kind of news and public affairs and documentaries from a left political perspective, you couldn't get that on Time Warner now. But if Time Warner were to just add that to a menu, folks might pay $5 a month to see something like that. Have you heard people talking about those kinds of opportunities?
We need more people talking about that. The people who are talking about that are some of the programmers who find that they can't get on cable because Comcast or Time Warner doesn't want to add them to a huge bundle that everybody's going to have to take. But what happens if you give people choices and control over their cable bill, the cable industry now becomes a model of trying to sell you as many channels that you want, not the channels that might fit best into a big bundle that everybody else will have to see too. So these progressive channels can get on. If they can find their space, the cable companies are going to try to push for you to subscribe to them because they target you directly, more so than a generic channel reaching the entire mainstream could.
Mm-hmm. Well, finally, let's talk the big picture. A cynic might say, well, this all sounds nice, but the cable companies are going to find a way to get what they want, and we'll be left with, at best, a few crumbs. The optimists see some real potential here, maybe even a way to bring, like we're saying, more challenging programming to the airwaves. What can citizens do now to make sure we get the best possible outcome with a la carte?
Well, right now in Congress, senators and congressmen are debating whether or not cable channel choice, whether you should have more options. And they're even debating whether or not new competitors like telephone companies should be allowed to roll out new video services faster than they currently can. So Congress right now is investigating these opportunities. Consumers need to make their voices heard and tell Congress that first you want the cable channels you want and don't have to go through all the schlock of the stuff that you don't want to have to watch. And so right now consumers should go on hearusnow.org and click on Get Heard, and so they can take control of their cable bill and let Congress know that they're tired of the status quo.
We've been speaking with Kenneth DeGraff. He's a policy advocate at Consumers Union in Washington, D.C. Find out more about their media campaigns at www.hearusnow.org. Kenneth DeGraff, thanks so much for joining us on Counterspin.
Thank you, Peter.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bi-monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call 1-800-847-3993. That's 1-800-847-3993. And be sure and tell them you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. That's www.fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
This is Independent Native News for Friday, the 17th of February, 2006. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. Methamphetamine is a growing problem on reservations across the country, but proposed cuts in this year's fiscal budget will affect statewide efforts around the country to curb the problem, no matter where it occurs. In the Pacific Northwest, law enforcement teams are worried about losing the resources they rely on to fight the spread of meth. Elizabeth Wynn Johnson reports.
Roberta Silva of Idaho State Police explains what it would mean to lose $2 million in federal funding for drug-related services.
All of their undercover operations and their meth bust, their lab work, all of those operations will be very hard to pursue.
The proposed cuts are part of the Bush administration budget rolled out this week. They continue a downward trend in federal support, but Silva says these programs aren't underperforming. State agencies just haven't bragged enough.
Because they have been very successful, and state agencies and beneficiaries of those funds did not do enough to get in the spotlight their successes.
And that doesn't just go for Idaho. Rob Bovet is attorney for the Oregon Narcotics Enforcement Association. He says the proposed cuts come at a crucial time for the region.
Here in the Northwest, we truly are where the meth epidemic started. So we've had it bad for the longest period of time. The good news is we are on the forefront of the solutions also. And because of that, the funding is just that much more critical for us, since we are leading the pack in addressing the remedies to the meth epidemic.
The president's budget would channel money toward the Drug Enforcement Agency and Homeland Security, but officials say that would leave many small and rural Northwest communities without any funding for a continuum of anti-drug services. I'm Elizabeth Wynn Johnson in Coeur d'Alene.
The World Eskimo Indian Olympics, or WEIO, which is held in Fairbanks, Alaska every summer, is asking for financial help to keep the games from possibly moving to Anchorage. Since 1961, contestants and dance teams from all over Alaska and the Circumpolar North have come to Fairbanks to compete in the games, which are a test of strength, agility, balance, and endurance, all skills needed to sustain hunting and survival activities in the north. Originally, the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce sponsored WIO as part of the city's historical Golden Days celebration, but that partnership ended after the 1969 games. Now the Chamber is looking at renewing ties with WIO in an attempt to keep the games in town. Brenda Hewitt serves as rural outreach with the Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation. She says members of the WIO board came to the Rural Urban Committee asking for help, and the response was positive.
All of our political leaders and community leaders have said, we want WIO to stay in Fairbanks, Alaska, and we'll do what it takes to make sure that they stay here. So we're also helping them with maybe trying to find some other sponsorship.
Sharing insurance costs and moving the games to a bigger venue so visitors and locals can learn about the importance of the cultural games are among ideas the Chamber is considering. Rural Urban Committee co-chair Richard Carroll says Fairbanks showed its support for the Native community when it rolled out the red carpet in October for the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention, and he believes the same will be true for WIO.
We've seen it as a positive way to support the Native culture and diversities of people and building understanding between rural and urban communities, and a great opportunity.
According to WIO's website, in 1970, Alaska's Tundra Times newspaper took over sponsorship of the games, then called the World Eskimo Olympics. In 1973, the board of directors changed the name to the World Eskimo Indian Olympics. 3 years later, an independent nonprofit corporation was formed for the sole purpose of planning, preparing, and staging the event. The current director of WIO declined an interview for this story. This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Ridolfi Incorporated, using engineering and science to improve the quality of the environment for over 15 years. RIDOLFI.com. And by Amerind Risk Management Corporation, a native venture protecting Indian Country's assets. www.amerind-corp.org. Our theme music is provided by Jeff Silverman. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.